The Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Clapp for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Clapp. This is the HOD Hour with Stan Clapp.
And I'm Stan Clapp, and I'm here tonight because this is the start of National Nutrition Week, which started on the 9th, which is yesterday. It seems a bit strange for us Jewish people who probably didn't think about nutrition too much yesterday, or you shouldn't have been. And it goes on till the 15th. I have as my guest tonight Gail Landau, and she's a qualified nutritionist, dietetics from the University of Cape Town. She has a long CV here. I don't want to go through it with everything, but let me say this, that if I take it by her looks, she's definitely an advert for the program. Whatever she's selling or whatever she's doing it right. And she began her interest in the non-diet approach about 14 years ago. And that's what we're really going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about intuitive nutrition or intuitive eating. And Gail, I just want to make a point because one of my favorite authors is Mark Twain. And I like some of these old sayings because they're usually very apt. And he said, part of the secret of a success in life is to eat what you like and let the food fight it out inside. Does that make sense?
So actually there's a doctor in the United States who writes extensively on mindful eating, and she talks about eat what you love what you eat. So we're not into the food fight, but rather into trying to restore a healthy relationship with food and a better mind-body connection, which is often affected from years and years of dieting, as well as having a strong diet mentality, and also by issues such as weight bias or weight stigma that is actually very prevalent in today's society.
Especially in men, we tend to be judgmental. We tend to judge a book by its cover. And that goes back to school days, goes back to the period thereafter. And so I'm probably the worst culprit. I don't know, I just eat intuitively. I just eat whenever I think there's food around. I've tried the different eating plans. I've had a small measure of success. But I like what you say, because you've given us 10 points. And the first of it is to drop the whole notion of diet and to concentrate rather on other aspects of how you should eat and what you're about, and to know yourself in a sense. So I'm sorry to ramble on a little bit as an introduction, but in my way of eating is I talk about comfort food, and comfort food to me is the food that makes me feel comfortable. When I've eaten, am I satisfied? Will it pass through my body successfully? And is it healthy for me? So probably the worst culprit, because I like junk food, but I also like to try and eat sensibly when I can. So take us through the beginning of this. You're not talking about diets, you're talking about a specific process.
Okay, so intuitive eating is a program that was essentially developed by two American dietitians back in 1995, Evelyn Triboli and Elise Resch. They collaborated as they were feeling disillusioned and frustrated by the whole diet process. And they collaborated and they came up with 10 core principles that they felt identified what made someone an intuitive or a natural eater. And those 10 principles are the foundation of their book. They've subsequently, I think it's in now the third edition. And initially, their approach was really just the two of them, until a psychologist took it on board to actually try to validate, can you actually call someone an intuitive eater? And to date, there are over 70 clinical studies that affirm intuitive eating as an evidence-based non-diet approach. So it's not just saying, oh, I'm an intuitive eater. It's a process. And really when someone calls themselves an intuitive eater, the first thing is, intuitive eaters give themselves unconditional permission to eat. And that's where we have to explore the first principle of intuitive eating, which is rejecting the diet mentality. So if your food choices or decision is really governed by calories, eat this or don't eat that, you should or you shouldn't. That's very much about the diet mentality. And intuitive eating isn't just about mindless eating. Intuitive eating isn't mindful eating, but it certainly embraces elements of mindfulness. So intuitive eating is also about giving yourself time, place, and space, some context in which to eat. And that's part of the other, some of the other principles around honoring your hunger and respecting your fullness.
But in society, in my society, it sort of conspires against you. Let me give you an example. This coming week, we're going to be National Nutrition Week, but we're also going to be in Sukkot, and we're going to be sitting in people's sukkahs, and we're going to be pushed to eat whatever is there. So you don't have much choice. So you've got to really look after what you're doing and see what you're doing, because the danger is you're going to follow the whole process course by course and inevitably overeat.
Okay. So again, the first thing comes back to the whole issue with the diet mentality is, if you go into an approach with a whole lot of food rules, what generally happens is a mindset of some element of deprivation, and even the thought of depriving yourself might set you off to eat a whole lot more, because you don't know, you know, it's like that last meal, last supper effect that you're going to fill up on.
Or you'll have a meal before you go, just in case you're not going
to
get enough.
Correct. So that's very much the diet mentality, or the diet mentality that tells you to drink lots of water or have free vegetables or soup the whole day before, so that because you're going to have a big fress in the evening. So the first thing is that when we're talking about intuitive eating, we're talking about this concept of attunement. Tuning into your body for signals of hunger and fullness. And unlike a diet, which always starts on Monday or tomorrow, intuitive eating is a consciousness. It's a process of being in the present moment. So right now at this hour, tuning in and kind of sensing what is my level of hunger or awareness. And that would be the same whether it's Shabbos or Yom Tov, because a lot of people diet or eat very restrictively during the week, and come Shabbos it's excessive, or Yom Tov is excessive, and people feel very out of control and guilty around Yom Tov meal. So we want to have some pleasure and enjoyment at the Yom Tov meal, but the first thing is, don't set yourself up for failure by arriving at the meal ravenously hungry, because already you're on the back foot and you're more likely to eat very quickly. And you're also more likely to go for what I call a quick fix food, anything that's going to fill the gap until you're able to feel satiated or feeling a sense of fullness.
But does one get that feeling? Because I found that mostly one tends to get into the function or into the room, or even at home, and you'll have a meal, and then of course there's a little bit left over, so you're tempted, should I have some more? First of all, the question is, am I eating the right thing? But besides that, the quantity. So how do you train yourself or teach yourself that you've had enough?
Okay.
Or you push the table away.
All right.
Or push the chair away from the table.
So the first thing is, again, when there's the mindset of deprivation or a diet cheat or the diet mentality, and often this is what causes a breakdown in trust with the body. If you have been a serial dieter, or you're always on diet, or you're always the slave to the meal plan, you're always eating when or what or how much is on the meal plan, and that breaks down your level of trust. So when you're not dieting, it doesn't mean you can't pay attention to those physical signs and symptoms. And certainly in a social context, at a brocha, at a buffet, it might be a little bit harder, because there's an element of distracted eating. So if you tend to eat in your car, eat on the go, or you eat standing at the brocha, you eat while you putting food on your plate and you picking off that is example of distracted or mindless eating. So try to give yourself a context in which to eat. So at in terms of how do you start noticing your fullness, you've got to first be aware of what is your level of hunger going into the event. And sometimes it's about pausing during the brocha, during the meal, and it may be about putting your knife and fork down or taking a pause halfway and kind of checking in. And it is also about the unconditional permission to eat, to say, well, if I still love this kichel and herring, I can come and have it tomorrow or maybe the next day. It's not disappearing out of sight and out of mind. So sometimes that deprivation mindset also causes you to overindulge because of the fear of, you know, the deprivation.
So haven't we sort of been brainwashed to the extent that There's breakfast, lunch, and supper. You've got to have a good breakfast. You have to have a, eat like a king at lunchtime, a pauper in the evening, or else you have your main meal. You come home, you have the main meal at night. Aren't we kind of trained to that from youth, from our childhood?
So in terms of, it's important when you're looking at intuitive eating to understand what is actually normal eating, because in the face of social media and all these weird and wonderful diets out there, from intermittent fasting to paleo to all these other weird and wonderful quick fix solutions that promise you thinness, success and wonderment in a package. The problem is people no longer know what to do. But normal eating is that most people will probably need to refuel or eat something maybe at a 3 or 4 hourly interval. But that differs from person to person. It's going to be different depending on your age. It may be influenced by your physical activity factors. It may be influenced by a medication that you're taking, whether or not you need to eat 3 times a day or 5 times a day or twice a day. So it's, again, not getting caught up in a rule that, oh, it's 1 o'clock, I must eat lunch.
Are you looking for a balance? Are you looking for like a balanced diet, a dark chocolate and a milk chocolate?
So a balanced diet in terms of intuitive eating, we talk about gentle nutrition. Interestingly enough, it's the 10th principle. Even though the book was written by registered dietitians, they appreciated that if you introduce too much nutrition science too early on, people will use that to become a nutrition informant instead of using it to be a nutrition ally. What we mean by that is that you can use those rules to sabotage your own self-trust too early on in the process. But gentle nutrition is about understanding that all foods can be included and enjoyed as part of a balanced diet. And where gentle nutrition comes in is taking into account maybe specific health requirements that you have. So it might be valuable to know how much fiber or where to find fiber in your diet. Or if you have diabetes, it's valuable to know which foods contain carbohydrate. So it is still important to get guidance from a registered dietitian so that you know how to have a balanced diet. But it's about not saying milk chocolate is better than dark chocolate. It's about saying having them together is the balance. it's about being neutral and also being mindful of your language and not labeling food as junk, or because junk is what you put in a dustbin, and your body is not a dustbin. Your body is a vessel. It's something that's carrying your neshama. It's something that deserves respect and kindness, and it doesn't need to be punished or rewarded with food.
So Mark Twain also said, by the way, he said, be careful about reading health books. You could die of a misprint.
Well, isn't that the truth? Because today what we're seeing, and this is very much an issue today, is the issue of weight bias and weight stigma. And that is that weight and obesity and fat discrimination is almost accepted as acceptable, and it's not acceptable. I often hear people in large bodies make a lot of disparaging comments about their own body. People make jokes. And the sad reality is that just having that mindset is internalized, and that those messages get reinforced time and time again. And unfortunately, it's associated with poor health outcomes. We see people who feel afraid that they might be weighed at the doctor or be told that they are fat or judged because of their size, that they are lazy or incompetent. I mean, these are common stigmas that go with size discrimination. Actually, seek medical help less often, are less engaged in physical activity and movement because they feel so poorly about their body. And unfortunately, dieting is actually associated with the same outcomes. People who chronically diet, go on and off diets, tend to have poorer body dissatisfaction, have higher levels of anxiety, stress, depression. And so we see actually weight bias and weight bias internalization, as well as dieting, have the same poor health outcomes.
But it's kind of self-perpetuating, because you start off looking what to eat, you've eaten, now you start looking off what to excuse it, and so you go through the whole process.
So that's
where do we actually start? Let's take a typical day. So Stan wakes up in the morning, he's has a cup of coffee, which I suppose is neither wrong nor right, and then now he's going to have breakfast. So is breakfast on the menu, or can you decide, look, I'm not really feeling like eating today. Now I'm going to eat at 11 o'clock or whatever it is.
So in the early process of intuitive eating, it really is the process of learning to trust and be attuned or tuning into how your body is feeling. Because many cases we reach for food or whatever on autopilot without even thinking. And we might be filling up on foods that are always there, but we don't even really love or feel like. It's just
It's mechanical.
And I have to say that in many cases, certainly a lot of the male clients that come to me come under the duress of a partner or a friend or a spouse or forced to be there because of the doctor, because they don't really take ownership of the food choices themselves. It's outsourced. Their health is outsourced.
So in the morning I get up, I'm going to have breakfast. So I choose what I want and I have it. Now I'm faced with the day. So I'm thinking to myself, now I'm leaving now and I'm going to be in the office or I'm going to be out. So possibly I can go to a restaurant or a coffee shop and have something to eat, or I can take food with me. Now, if I'm going to pack my food, it's no longer intuitive. I'm thinking at 7 o'clock in the morning. Now I'm already planning till lunchtime.
Okay.
So the thing repeats itself. And you know, in the evening, you work your way around, because you're going to come home and you know at top of 6 or 7, you're going to sit down with your family and you're going to eat. And now the kids aren't eating, so you've got to set the example. Or it's just you and your spouse and you're going to eat what's given to you. But as you said, you're not the one that's planned the meal. So maybe your wife thinks she'd rather have a steak and you'd rather, you know, you wouldn't want that. So how do you balance that in your, I know that diet, I've chucked the idea of diet out. I've always sort of, but I've always adhere to some sort of eating plan. So, because I get hungry lunchtime. I used to get a migraine if I didn't eat it in the morning. So by 10 o'clock, I knew I had to eat. Maybe it's just in my psyche, but in the reality of it is that's what's carried me through all my years, is those sort of eating things. I'm not sure about what's actually in the food or if I'm eating the right thing. And my gut feeling tells me, sorry about the pun, that the food that I am eating at regular meals is the correct food.
Correct.
What happens incorrectly is what happens between the meals.
Okay, so we've got to first go back to the breakfast. And the first thing is waking up in the morning and actually assessing and almost taking a moment to think about how hungry you are, because the amount that you eat ideally should be attuned or match your level of hunger. So on a hungry day, maybe you're going to have a more substantial breakfast. And that obviously depends on your like. So maybe a more substantial breakfast, maybe a cooked breakfast. But on another day where you're not that hungry, or you know you've got a possibility of having a mid-morning or a later snack, maybe something lighter might get you through the morning. The issue of whether you pack lunch or go on the way and find something along the way is really the starting process is about curious observation and knowing what is your pattern of behavior. If you know where the place that you work doesn't have kosher food, for example, then you're going to be kind to yourself and pack something from home if you keep kosher. If there is access to food that you enjoy and it's affordable and accessible, then you can buy and go on the way and choose what you feel like. But taking food with you is actually a process of self-care, seeing nutrition as an element of self-care. And sometimes you might have a meal when you're not particularly hungry, because that's I call practical hunger, because maybe you're going to eat an early lunch at 12 because you've got a meeting and another meeting, and the next opportunity you're going to have to eat is 5 o'clock. And you know, based on your own physical experiences, that if you leave it going for too long, you're likely to get a headache or you're not going to feel great within yourself. So that's the process of intuitive eating, is going in the moment. And if it's not impossible to take food with, then take that with. It's not the end of the world. And when you come to the evening meal with the family, we definitely recommend meals at a table versus meals in front of the TV. Family meals are very important, and it's of great benefit not only to have that family connection with your spouse, but for children and grandchildren, because it's a place where we model good eating habits. And then certainly you can't always have what you always feel like. Sometimes, you know, there's steak on the menu, you might not feel like steak. And sometimes you've got to go with the flow and be flexible. And sometimes you might not have the most enjoyable meal of your taste, but it's not the end of the world. There will be another opportunity. If every meal that you're having is not satisfying, you're filling up on food that you think you should eat and it's not satisfying and enjoyable, that's when you've got to start exploring your meal choices and is there variety in your diet? Is there...
But are you not adhering, or should you be adhering to things like you've got to have five veggies, you've got to have three fruits, you have to have starch in the morning and not in the evening? So do those rules still apply, or is that out of the window?
So with intuitive eating, it's very important to explore the rule and to understand where did that rule come from and do you understand the intention behind the rule. So I'm going to compare this to kashrut. When people choose to be kosher, if they understand the intention behind it, there isn't a sense of deprivation that their friend is eating a cheeseburger and they're not eating a cheeseburger. They don't feel they're missing out. If they really have made a commitment to kashrut, they don't really feel they're missing out on it. But if you have a rule like carbs, or no carbs at night, or you have to eat a certain amount, until you really understand how that feels within your body, to have it or to not have it, there might be a sense of deprivation and resentment whether you have it or you don't have it. There might be guilt having it or resentment by not having it. So it's a process of actually understanding where that rule came from. Certainly we recommend having adequate fiber in the diet, and yeah, we talk about having 15 to 30 grams of fiber per day. Are you going to know where to find all that fiber without guidance? Probably not, but if you
Google,
yeah, you can Google it, as everybody Dr. Googles everything. But you know, therein is also a risk that you might Google information that makes you confused. So seek help from a registered dietitian, or God forbid you die from a misprint, but you know, seek guidance and do it sensibly. Certainly, having adequate fiber, knowing which foods contain cholesterol would all be part and parcel of intuitive eating. We've just got to be careful not to be too caught up in the food rules early on in the process of intuitive eating, because as I mentioned, it's the 10th step and there are many other principles that come before that, such as honor your hunger, respect your fullness. Sometimes it's about making peace with food and taking away the food rules. It might be about managing emotional eating. I know you mentioned food that feels comfortable for your body, but many people struggle with an unhealthy relationship with food and actually use food because it might be the only aspect of joy or pleasure that they have in their life, and it becomes an emotional connection to the food. So we would,
sure.
You know,
and
there
you
many
the dietitian is your psychiatrist.
Well,
or your psychologist.
I think many dietitians do. Do a lot of counseling, but they're not many dietitians who practice a non-diet approach. So if, you know, it's very different when you're getting a meal plan versus the type of work that I do, which is very, I would say, quite psychologically focused.
So are there no-nos that you shouldn't have, like don't have this kind of food at all? Or is that dependent on you? Do you do an assessment of, somebody comes to you and they say, listen, I don't know where to even begin. Now, is there a no-no?
So every assessment will always start with a thorough medical history. I'll always ask what medication, what surgical treatment or underlying medical issues there are. Then I'll always look at allergies. So if you are allergic to peanuts, I'm going to say nuts are an absolute no-no. But unless you're allergic to something, there's no absolute no unless you know it doesn't really feel good in your body. So there's a difference between allergy and food intolerance, and I work a lot with irritable bowel syndrome and patients who have issues with their gut. And certainly that's something that one might need to explore. If every time you eat a certain food, you experience adverse side effects, or
sure,
if you're getting gout every time you have a beer, you know, then it's important to understand why that's happening. But there's that always needs to be individualized nutrition advice. There's no blanket rule, because what works for you might not work for your neighbor, even though you might be the same age and you might appear the same. Everybody's body is unique and everyone's got their own unique likes and dislikes when it comes to food.
So
there's no absolute no's. It has to be individualized. And then it also depends on what your intention is behind coming for dietary advice. If you've got underlying diabetes, for example, it would be important for me to help you to feed yourself at reliable intervals, and so that you can understand your diabetes. And from a diabetes point of view, we talk about weight neutral for diabetes care, that it's still possible to have good diabetes control. You don't always have to have weight loss as an objective in order to have good diabetes control.
So I, over my many years, and I'm only 27, I've experienced with a lot of different things. At one stage, I went on a completely protein diet. I got so hungry that I could eat a chicken for breakfast and maybe a chicken for lunch. A whole chicken. I'm not talking about just a leg. But what I found is that wasn't really doing it for me. So I was looking for other stuff. So I started introducing orange juice, or it was really an unbalance for me. Although I started losing weight and I started feeling well with it and so on. Later on, I was running and I was doing comrades and I was doing marathon running for a while. Not that I was winning the races, but between Bruce Fordyce and I, that was really the whole race. And for about a year, I went completely vegetarian. And then it didn't work for me. And in fact, I think I developed a little bit of arthritis from that. And moving on from there, I started eating breakfast, lunch, and no supper. So I had a big meal at lunchtime. I had no supper in the evening. My weight dropped. I ran my best time for comrades that year, and I really felt well. But I found that I couldn't sustain it. Just the whole environment didn't allow me to sustain it. Also, for over 40 years, I haven't eaten red meat. So I only eat chicken and fish. I don't know. My cholesterol levels are within norms. Would I have been different? I don't know. So certain things I've experimented with. I know what makes me feel good and what doesn't, but I don't know. And I know that if I adhere to certain regimes that I've been given over a period or eating plans, and I'm religious about it, the weight drops off me and I do feel well. But I found that then boredom sets in. So every week I'm doing the same thing. Every day I'm doing the same thing. And I'm sure that that must be typical of most men.
Most women. Yeah, I would say what you're describing is very typical of a chronic dieter. So the whole getting back into the whole diet thing, as soon as the intention is with weight loss on the agenda and your decision to eat or not eat whatever is driven by weight loss, what lands up happening is you're going to get caught up in the food rules. You might include or exclude certain foods from your diet, and ultimately it might last in the short term, and dieting is very much an external process. So you're very much dependent on the number on the scale or external validation from people around you to say, oh, looking fabulous. And every time you thin praise, remember that someone is feeling fat shamed every time you thin praise. Let's stop noticing people for how they look, but rather for the qualities that they carry. Just getting back to this whole diet mentality, the chronic vicious diet cycle is that you go on diet, there's a short term high from being on the diet and feeling motivated and strong. And yes, there sometimes are health benefits in the short term, but 95% of diets fail because most people will somehow relapse and feel some element of deprivation, both physical and psychological, which will then have a rebound effect. I always say for every deprivation, there's an equal and opposite binge. And so what happens is you're either going to overeat all the foods you feel safe, so excessive amount of vegetables, fruit, whatever is allowed on your diet plan, or you're going to go and have exactly what wasn't on the diet plan and have a lot of it. And either way, you're going to eat beyond your point of full. You're going to overeat, you're going to overfull your belly and have some element of physical discomfort. And if there's a lot of food rules caught up in there, there might be a lot of psychological discomfort too, having a lot of overthinking, oh, guilt, shame, shouldn't have done that. And then you might just carry on that vicious cycle. So the problem here is that diets are the cause of your struggle, and we have to let go of those food rules to actually move beyond that and explore health. So your exercise, for example, is something that's very much part and parcel of intuitive eating, but we don't take on exercise the way we do dieting. It's not an all or none effect. It's not exercise until you injured and sore. It's about moving your body in a way that feels comfortable and get moving. A lot of people are so intimidated by their size that they don't even want to move. Then I'm going to say, see a biokineticist, see a physio and get moving.
Sedentary life. But so for me, it's less of wanting to lose the weight as opposed to wanting to be able to be in a position for my performance to be better. So when I say that, I'm talking about I go to work and I want to feel energetic throughout the day. I don't want to start yawning at lunchtime. And I find that if I haven't eaten correctly, I am yawning at lunchtime, and then I'm starting to drop off my, I don't know what, if it's blood sugar or what the real term is, but I know that there's a dip through the afternoon where I need something. So whether it's only a cup of coffee or whether it's a bowl of ice cream or it's a chocolate or it's a, something healthy, I don't know, or a fruit. So I was eating a fruit in the morning, a fruit in the afternoon, a yogurt in the morning and a yogurt in the afternoon, kind of had some guideline which tended to really help that along. I just, I have to then force myself to plan accordingly and pack the lunch and take it with me, because I, otherwise if I'm in the office, I'm certainly not going to go looking for food.
Yeah. So, it's so one must also hand. Remember that not all elements of fatigue, not every discomfort or always needs food as a solution. So the first thing we also want to explore around energy levels is what else is happening in your life. Are you getting enough sleep? If you snore, it could be a reason why you might not be getting good sustained sleep, and maybe that needs to be evaluated. If, you know, and I'm not saying for you, but let's say someone who has got poorly controlled diabetes might have unstable blood sugar levels and have a slump in the afternoon. So it's always important. You've got to first get the medical stuff sorted out and just rule out that there aren't any underlying medical reasons for ongoing fatigue. I mean, it could be something like underlying anemia. There might be blood sugar levels, blood pressure issues. So it's important to have a checkup. And I'm really going to encourage the male listeners out there that you don't need to wait for someone to make that appointment for you. You can pick up the phone your GP and go for a physical and have the routine bloods, have a fasting blood glucose done, have your lipogram, your blood cholesterol levels checked, have your blood pressure checked, know your numbers, but don't get so freaked out by the numbers. Then it's about doing something about them and exploring health behaviors towards that. So there's not one, you know, solution for everybody. Not everybody needs a fruit in the morning and a fruit in the afternoon. Again, that needs to be individualized care and taking into account lifestyle factors like exercise, sleep, medication, stress. All of those things are also equally important to address, and that is also addressed in intuitive eating.
So if you took a random group of people and you said to them and you tested them, so you would find, I presume, that this person is a good steak eater, and the next person isn't. The next person shouldn't have chicken, and so on. And many people have come up with those type of things. And I find that once you, if you start doing that, you start driving yourself mad for looking for the foods that you should. I just felt always that I wanted to be a little bit freer of all of that, you know, the shackles of the food.
Yeah.
And to, like, if I really wanted to have only an ice cream for lunch, so can't I do that?
You can. As, with intuitive eating, one can do that. Part of intuitive eating, one of the principles is discovering the satisfaction factor and figuring out what components of a meal need to be there for it to be satisfying and enjoyable for you. So there may be days that, yeah, you do just have an ice cream for lunch, but I promise you most intuitive eaters won't eat ice cream every day for lunch, because the reality is that from the research that we see is intuitive eaters over time generally do make healthier food choices if we compare, but they get there through their own self-discovery. They don't get driven there by food rules. It's a journey of self-discovery. So yes, there may be an occasion where you do have an ice cream, but if you're a person who likes texture, you might not find that satisfying, and you might rather feel more satisfied by a muesli, or you might be more satisfied by a crunchy apple. So it's important, again, to be a curious observer of your own habits, your own food choices, and also figuring out how long is that meal going to sustain you or keep you feeling full. If you're just having an ice cream for lunch, I'm not surprised that by 4 o'clock you probably are having a bit of an energy slump, because in your own experience, a balanced meal that's got maybe, you know, even a chicken sandwich or a tuna sandwich would probably get you to dinner time probably a lot better than an ice cream. But it, again, on some days the ice cream might just do the trick and it will be enough.
So we're, Hebrew of David is 115 years old.
Mazel tov.
Been established in 1904 in South Africa. It's a fraternity, a worldwide fraternity with lodges around the world. Of course, food is essential to our existence. All our meetings are followed by a meal. We never go hungry. So if you belong to the Hebrew of David, you just won't go hungry. Sorry, you're a lady and you can't join, but for men who want to become part of the soil, remember that food is always there. Problem is, you're having a meeting and the meeting starts at 8 o'clock, and you go through to half past nine, whatever it is. Now you come out and we have a light meal, but sometimes a light meal is pizza, and sometimes it's a pie, and sometimes it's something healthy. I can't imagine that we've ever had, but we've had things like sausages and hot dogs and all that stuff that guys like to eat. Maybe there's a whiskey on the table. Should you be having it or shouldn't you have it? Never mind about the driving. You might be the passenger. But in the same time, should we be looking at those type of things, or what we should be feeding people? And is it okay to come home at, or to finish a meeting at 9:30 and then eat? Is it something which you, because a lot of people say, I can't eat this late.
So I think certainly a part of our Jewish way of socializing and our culture is, and it's not only unique to Judaism, is that food is central to how we socialize. I mean, if you talk about people's memories, or we talk about positive food memories, there are many positive food memories, and we'll talk about chicken soup and knedlach, and, you know, for some people there might be, you know, there is always a positive association with food. Does every meeting have to have food? I don't always agree that it has to always have food. Is it more about the connection, and meeting with people might be equally served well with, you know, tea and coffee, or eat the meal first and then have the meeting, because people are probably arriving straight from work and might be quite ravenous, and you might have maybe a more productive meeting.
If you might
have a sleepy meeting, because there is a digestive phenomenon that does occur when you, after eating a big meal or heavy meal, that you might feel sluggish or tired. So, you've got to maybe be selective about what you serve and the context in which you serve. But I think you must also put into context, how often are you having these meetings? Is it an everyday thing? Is it a once a week thing? It all comes down. It's not every single day that you're eating that way or eating that late. So does it always need to be fixed? And yes, you can certainly provide healthier options, and we can discuss that another time, but it doesn't always need to be frowned upon. It's not always terrible. Does that make sense? I think
but the only problem is, just going back to the beginning of what you were saying, is that if we don't have food, I don't know if the members will pitch, because food is a critical part of our, you know, it's become part of what we do. But just, can we just talk about things like a choice? Meat, fish, poultry.
Okay, so in terms of, you know, there are South African food-based national guidelines which are there to guide the public in terms of making healthier food choices. And where possible, if there is a choice, again, the choice is going to depend on what you enjoy the taste of and what feels good in your body. So you mentioned earlier that you haven't eaten red meat. So you don't have to start eating red meat. And certainly the trend today, and certainly the recommendations from a Mediterranean style diet, which is really what's internationally recognized for cardiovascular disease and diabetes, is having maybe more plant-based protein, which is looking at things like legumes, chickpeas, lentils, plant-based protein, fish more often, and then poultry, and then less often red meat. And certainly from a cancer prevention point of view, certainly things that increase risk for colorectal cancer and bowel cancer is a high intake of processed meat. So things like sausages, and maybe that's something you can look at HOD, is maybe not providing your members with the same type of snacks all the time. Don't always make it pies and sausages and that type, and biltong, and maybe some of the time might be a fish option. But again, you want to get the members there, and you're going to get them there with meat, because they are South African at the end of the day.
Well, the thing is that you traditionally we know what we're going to eat. We have the food groups. You know that you're going to have the bread groups, or you're going to have cereal, or those type of things. It's choosing which particular one is the right one. Or you're going to have fruit, and so I presume that some fruits are better than others.
All fruits offer value. All fruits are a source of fruit sugar, fructose, and all fruits give you fiber. The thing is, having a variety in your diet, and that's also a food-based dietary guideline, is to enjoy variety and not just eat the same fruit all the time, but have variety and go with the fruits that you enjoy. And certainly if you need more fiber, you can be guided by a registered dietitian of which fruits might be higher in fiber than other fruits. But vegetables and fruit should definitely be part and parcel of a diet. It's the way you add color to your plate. It's the way you add fiber, and it's the way you add antioxidants, which have many health protective benefits. So, again, not getting too caught up in the food rule, but if you're eating the same monotonous type of foods all the time, if the meals you offer lack color, maybe it's about offering baby tomatoes and cucumber as options, as and not only always, you know, something that's processed, that's high in salt and nitrates and nitrites, which have got poor health outcomes if you eat them often all the time.
So I have a, in the studio my guest Gail Landau. She's a dietitian. Not only is she a dietitian, she's really very interested in all aspects of eating, particularly in the nutrition part of it. And she's really trying to steer us away from the diet approach. So she wants a non-diet approach. She's really talking up the notion of intuitive eating. And have I left anything out in that explanation of who you are and what you are?
No, I think that's a fair description. I am a registered dietitian, and I've done a subsequent training, and I'm a certified intuitive eating counselor. And yeah, I'm very passionate about spreading the message that dieting can be harmful. It's not the only way to attain good health. If we can just stop pursuing the number on the scale and start exploring our, not only our food choices, but our relationship with food as well, I think it will serve us all much better in the long term.
So what is the yardstick for knowing that if you're successful in this approach? So, I mean, intuitively, sorry to use that word, is my approach would be, am I able to take down a notch of my belt in the morning when I put my denims on or my pants or my suit?
Okay.
Is my bar mitzvah suit still going to fit me? And so on. And I'm sure that most women would feel it's a question of size to fit into the clothes that they have, and men would feel the same, because I think that comes back to my comfort idea, is that, you know, I want to put my clothes on and I want to sit comfortably and not feel straining at my shirt buttons popping off. There's got to be a yardstick, and there's got to be a way of
validating or measuring.
Yes, of measuring, really.
Okay.
What are you measuring it against?
So there are different ways. There is a validated assessment tool that comes with intuitive eating. As I mentioned, intuitive eating is a weight neutral approach. So losing weight or coming down a few notches on your belt might be an outcome, but it's not a guaranteed outcome when you follow the intuitive eating process. Some people gain weight initially with intuitive eating. Some people remain weight neutral. But it's important to recognize that yo-yo dieting, going up and down with the weight, has poorer health outcomes than being in a larger body and staying slightly heavier. So we want to be aware that the validated assessment scale, the first one is intuitive eaters give themselves unconditional permission to eat, but they also give themselves structure and routine. There's time, place, and space in which to eat. It's not a mindless free-for-all eat until you uncomfortably full program. The other thing is managing emotions and being able to eat for physical reasons and not always using food to cope with emotions. Another element of intuitive eating is being able to rely on internal signals of hunger and fullness. And the issue of body food choice congruence. So what I generally do is at an initial, or certainly in the first two visits, someone would do a validated assessment scale, and we would repeat that maybe at the 5-week mark or the 6-week mark, and they would be able to see a shift in their attitude. Certainly patients who struggle with issues like binging will report that they are binging less often, or they are binging but on a smaller quantity, and they feel more in charge and more connected to their body, and they are also starting to engage in other health behaviors. So we start seeing an improvement in their, for example, their HbA1c, their blood glucose level is more stable. They are more compliant with their medication. They are taking their cholesterol medication, or they are making maybe better choices for their body. So there are ways of validating and assessing health without always going back to the number on the scale.
I go to my GP and not feeling great that particular day. So he'll test how's my heart pumping? Is my blood pressure up or down? Maybe he'll do more extensive tests. Is that something you should be measuring on a regular basis?
I think it's always wise to, as I said, it's always important to get the medical things checked out. And I think what a lot of people don't discuss, and this is men and women alike, is a lot of people negate the impact of stress in our lives and how we cope and manage with stress. And often when you go to the doctor, they check your blood pressure and all of that. Everything looks fine, but you're still feeling not great. And no one actually ever talks about the issue that maybe you're not sleeping well at night. You're not feeling on top of things. And not everything requires medication, but sometimes it's just to talk about it or to be counseled adequately. And I think that is often a huge contributing factor to poor health. And the reason people don't go seek medical help is maybe they feel ashamed or embarrassed that they're not coping, they're not on top of everything. But it's certainly a very important factor, because if you're not coping with your stress, you may be eating poorly, your other elements of self-care are poor, and your eating might manifest as chaotic and irregular, or it might be quite monotonous. You might be filling up on the same type of foods all the time. You might not be exercising regularly. But often when you go to see a healthcare provider, one can feel intimidated in that environment and forget to even ask those very questions or to discuss the things that are really bothering you. So I always say it's important, get the medical stuff checked out first. Know your numbers. Have your blood pressure. Have, you know, also ask what medication you're taking. So many people, I ask them what's their medication. I take a blue tablet and a white tablet and a long one and a short one. And they actually don't even know the names of their medications. They don't know
what it's for.
They don't know what it's for. They don't read. That's part of your responsibility in terms of healthcare. Don't accept treatment without questioning it. If you're on a chronic medication, there's a reason for it. Ask the doctor, why am I taking this medication? Ask your pharmacist, why am I taking it? Am I getting the side effect because of this? Because often the compliance goes out the window because no one goes back to the same doctor and says, you know, on this treatment, I wasn't feeling great. They just throw it out the window and then go shopping to the next doctor or the next dietitian.
Until you get the right answer you want.
Until you get the answer that you want. So always tick the boxes. Have your checkups. Please, the men out there, please don't wait for other people to make those appointments for you. It's possible for you to see your GP if, you know, there are routine screenings that are important at different ages, like colonoscopies and prostate exams. They're not pleasant, but they need to be done. And really, it's all about prevention. And if prevention means a visit to the GP, then go for it.
So I've seen people go from very opposite extremes. Some will not eat, don't eat, will sit at a table and can push the food away with ease. Some people I've seen arrive at somebody's house with a bag, and in the bag is a scale together with food that they brought themselves, because now they've been told they've got to weigh this out and they've got to adhere to this kind of regime. And inevitably, somewhere along the line, this whole thing fails. So clearly there's got to be a lot to be said for being able to understand where you're going. And I mean, it's something which I'm sure all of us grapple with, not to some extent. Yeah. And also when you go to somewhere, what's the best advice? You go to, like I know if I go to Brucha, and I'm walking around with a plate in my hand, that's the death knell, because now I'm going to be putting stuff on my plate, and as I'm going from one section to the other, I'm eating it, and I'm just walking around the table, eating and packing my plate.
So you want to start being aware and have a consciousness and awareness of where you find yourself eating. So the first thing when you go to the Brucha is maybe scan the table and see, what is it that I really feel like? Of all the things that are available here, you also want to check in with yourself and question, am I even hungry? You don't always have to eat everything at the Brucha. Maybe for those who don't eat breakfast before, you know, might be hungry, and others might have had breakfast before and there isn't really even a need, but it's become the social context that you have to eat. You don't have to eat everything.
Maybe you just have a glass of water.
But again, it's not a rule. So I would say first scan what it is that you feel like. Choose the thing that you most feel like. Put it on your plate. Find a fork and a knife if you can, and find a place to sit, or a quiet, if there aren't tables. I really do prefer it where there is a table where you can try sit and eat without distraction.
I agree with that.
You know, be a mensch. Sit at the table and take time to eat your food. And, you know, I think there's this frenzy at the Brucha. It's so unpleasant, you know, elbows up and, you know, as if there's no one's ever seen food before. It's rahmonis, actually, because we should have a bit of respect and take time that someone has prepared this food. And maybe you say a Brucha for a reason, because You are thankful for that food, but then make time to sit and enjoy that food.
You may have battled to get through to the front. Now you're going to make the most of it, of the queue. So we've been talking to Gail Landau, a registered dietitian, expert in intuitive eating. We've been discussing how it affects everybody, the men in the community, the women in the community. Gail, in the last minute that we have, and we're really at the end, something about yourself quickly, family?
So I have a lovely family. I'm married to Stan Landau. He's a specialist physician at the Center for Diabetes. And I have two lovely boys who are at home. I'm not sure if they're listening. And yeah, I'm very blessed to come from a family that are majority still in South Africa. And I thank you for the opportunity for being here today.
And it's been wonderful. And I would like to I'd like to be a fly on the wall at dinner time to see how you tell your kids not to eat that or eat that, or do you do that?
Well, that's a whole other discussion. With children, I take on an approach of another non-diet approach called Ellen Satter. You'll have to have me back so that I can have that discussion.
We're definitely going to do that. So, Gail, thank you very much. Tabu, thanks for pushing the buttons. Gail Landau has been our guest. We wish you well for coming Yontif, for Sukkot. May you enjoy it. May you don't overeat. May you push the plate away when you've had enough. And a good Shabbos this week and a really enjoyable Sukkah experience. And good night.